from WXXI News. This is 1370 Connection. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday, October 31st. I'm Elisa Orlando. Welcome to a special edition of 1370 Connections. Very special because we're going to spend the next hour not talking so much about the issues of the day, but about the issues of television, one of our favorite topics in public broadcasting, and we hope one of your favorite television shows, Downton Abbey. The new season of Downton Abbey kicks off on WXXI-TV on January 5th at 9 p.m., part of Masterpiece Theater. Downton Abbey, of course, is a period drama about the lives of British aristocrats, the Crawley family, and their servants. And as we have been talking about for the last hour or so, it's set against the backdrop of the great events in history, things like World War I, the sinking of the Titanic, and the Spanish flu epidemic, all of which play roles in the show's plot. Downton Abbey is one of the most critically acclaimed programs on TV, and part of the reason for that is its historical authenticity. Here at WXXI, we're pleased to have as a guest today the person who's responsible for much of that authenticity and historical accuracy, at least on the set of Downton Abbey. Alistair Bruce joins us on the line from London. He's the historical advisor to the program, and he's an expert on state ritual and social manners and behavior of the aristocracy throughout history. Thank you for being with us today, Alistair. I understand you're sitting at the microphone today in pretty much full military garb.
Good afternoon to you all. Yes, I'm a part-time soldier, and so I'm going straight on from this to a wonderful dinner.
Now, you've been a historical advisor on movies as well as Downton Abbey, including the King's Speech, and about a month from now you're going to be visiting Rochester, and we'll talk about that in a moment. On the set of Downton Abbey, you keep everything accurate, everything from the proper use of table linens to whether or not people kiss when they greet each other to whether the Lord of the Manor should put his hand in his pocket. You told a Scotland newspaper that this job, though, is not about etiquette, really.
Well, I always say it's about protocols because we all live by them and each society has its own way of doing things. And my job is to try and make sure that the protocols that were normal at the time that Downton Abbey is set are observed by people at the various different levels that they live in society. And, of course, we have the people below stairs who work in the kitchens right up to Lord Grantham and any visiting aristocracy who come. They all know, just as you and I do, how to naturally greet one another, and what is right and what is wrong. And that's merely protocol.
So describe for me day to day what it's like to do your job on the set. What are your responsibilities?
Well, the very first thing in the morning is when all the actors who are in the first scene gather wherever it's going to be filmed with the director. Normally in drama, there is then a discussion between the actors and the director on how to bring the words that have been written by Julian Fellowes to life. But I'm there to make sure that, in addition, they bear in mind what is correct for the time. So if the director wanted desperately for somebody to come rushing across the room and have a huge hug or something, I might be there to say, well, actually, they didn't do much of that sort of hugging stuff in those days. And what might be more appropriate is this, this, or this. And the great thing is they always listen to me.
And they must listen to you. How much authority do you have over how much can you tell them exactly what to do?
Well, in essence, I'm the historical advisor, and anyone who knows this industry will know that most advisors are broadly ignored. But in this one, I am taken very seriously because we have taken the view that in order to make the subconscious journey into the story of Downton Abbey feel right, we've got to get this kind of detail correct. And then the story will sing much more effectively off the pages.
Can you talk about how you get this kind of detail as you describe it? How do you get it right? What kinds of details do you pay attention to? What kinds of things are you telling the actors? Or how much are you interrupting scenes to tell them how to do things? I can imagine everything right down to the way they stand, sit down. Those are very, very, they're things that we don't even think about in modern day in terms of how we act, behave, and sort of our stature, our posture, our way of being.
Well, I hope I'm not a bore, but actors and actresses today are living in a world that is very different from the period that we're covering. And it's important sometimes to come up and just quietly say to one of the actresses, perhaps you might sit up a little straighter when they're sitting in a dining room. Because if they do, they look so magnificent by so doing. I just wish people would carry themselves a bit better than perhaps they do now. But they certainly did in those days. And it's because they all had nannies, these aristocrats, who were like a third parent. And the nanny in the nursery would have taught are delightful Mary and Edith, how to sit, how to conduct themselves. And these things will become totally second nature. But to an actress who lives today, it's not so second nature. And so I'm there always trying to help them deliver their performance by getting that kind of detail right.
So you're like their nanny.
Well, I suppose Nanny Bruce is always a great honour to aspire to.
This idea of critical attention to protocol and ritual and accuracy, how does it affect us, the people watching the programme, do you think?
Well, I think that, as I was hinting, if you can get people to feel that they are being legitimately carried into a period, that they can totally trust what they are seeing from left to right on the screen, then I think the story gains a greater credibility. There have been some wonderful dramas that have paid no attention whatever to getting the detail of a period right, and they have their own place. But Downton Abbey took a view that right from the outset, we would get everything right. We would get the right kind of flex coming out of the electric lights. We would make sure that whatever anyone was wearing, it was correctly put together, and that each table setting was put in the right way, and so when anything was laid, that it was correctly done. All that is probably irrelevant, you might say, but if the overall effect is to take people into something which I think has been quite effective and magical, none of us realised that there were going to be so many people around the world who wanted to watch this. We prayed for about 6 million people in Britain to watch it, and we now have about 120 million worldwide.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you oversee everything that the actors do in terms of historical accuracy. There are a lot of scenes in Downton Abbey that take place around the table. Can you talk a little bit about how you worked with the actors and the producers related to everything from table manners to table linens?
Manners are quite easy because you can watch how people eat. And obviously everyone eats very beautifully these days. But in comparison with how it was in those days, the habits of today are not quite so perfect. I'm just a very quiet, peaceful advisor in the background, and I only ever whisper it very quietly into the ears of the actors and actresses. What probably takes more planning is that when the director and the actors have decided how they're going to deliver the lines, I then have to make sure that the service, that is what the footmen are doing, and what Carson the butler is doing, fits in to that without getting in the way, but at the same time it's correctly done so that anybody who was to be brought alive again from that period would know that there's always a gap between two people being served when a number of things are brought round the table. And the footmen very quickly learn that, and I have a lot of time with all the different actors and I teach them about the period as it would affect them.
Do the cast members take the direction pretty well?
I've never had a problem. I think that they want to look good, and I'm here to help them do that. Obviously, I will never give them advice on how to act, but they know that I can give a great deal of help to their delivery of technical excellence. And they want to be, you know, the lovely thing about actors is you tell them what to do, and then they find something from somewhere you can't imagine and bring it to life in a far more effective way than you could have believe possible.
Do you have an example of that? Is there a moment when you gave a direction or a piece of advice and then you saw it come from a certain cast member, an example you can share with us about what that looked like to you and felt to you?
Well, I think it happens all the time, so that's probably not a very good answer. But I'll give you an example of something which mattered to me working with a director. And that is, and you will see this when the next series comes to America, there's one point where Carson and Lord Grantham are discussing the wine, and they are in the dining room doing this. I'm not giving any plot points away.
Thank you.
But you watch in the background, and you'll see the footmen are correctly measuring each chair from the table. Now, it's a tiny point, but it yet again gives a little bit of extra insight into the perfection of the time and the care with which this entire group of staff made efforts to ensure that the family's life was perfect.
Alistair Bruce is our guest on 1370 Connection today. He is the historical advisor to Downton Abbey. And, of course, we are live on the air. We can take your telephone calls at this time. If you'd like to call us and ask a question about the program, Alistair Bruce has a lot of information about the program, but especially about the history and the historical accuracy of the program. You can call us at 263-9994, 263-WXXI. And if you're enjoying the conversation today, there is more to come. WXXI is bringing Alistair Bruce to Rochester on November 26th. He'll be our guest and speaker at a luncheon at the Hyatt. And there's information on tickets and a VIP reception on our website at WXXI.org. Alistair Bruce, you are well prepared for this role as historical advisor. You're an expert on monarchy and heraldry. You're one of the Queen's heralds appointed to advise on state pomp and ceremony. Let me see if I can say this correctly. Fitzalan Persevant Extraordinary Herald. Is that correct? Close.
It'll
for an American?
Marvelously.
Thank you.
I think that's fantastic.
Thank you. You're part of the procession at the opening of Parliament, too.
That's right. I was appointed one of the Queen's heralds with the appointment title of Fitzalan Persevant of Arms Extraordinary, because I'm extra to the ordinary number, and that's how, in medieval times, they described somebody who was an additional officer. And my job is to be an expert on state ceremonial. Now, really oddly, I know a little bit more than most people can be bothered to learn about English coronation ritual. Now, how often does one need to bring that forth? Luckily, not too frequently. But I was brought into the College of Arms in order to support the Earl Marshal of England, who is responsible should we need to crown a new monarch.
So how did your interest in history begin? You were interested in your own family history, is that correct, from the very beginning?
Well, you know, family history is a tremendous trigger for all of us. And I was brought up with the fact that my ancestor, Robert Bruce, was King of Scots in the early 1300s. And he had defeated the English King Edward II at a battle called the Battle of Bannockburn. In fact, the 700th anniversary of that is next year. And I was absolutely captivated by discovering that I descend from this extraordinary man who was such a creature of his time and that he took unending risks. I mean, two of his brothers were hung, drawn and quartered in the pursuit of his own life by Aymer de Valence, who was the English general. Now, I just found that fascinating. And I just love discovering why, behind all the great questions that one faces, particularly with British history, and we've got so much tradition, I like to know why we do things. And when you unwrap that, it's like clues into a wonderful story about our past, and it has been the reason why I've written various books that do themselves try and unwrap wonderful things about British story and history.
As a historical advisor to Downton Abbey, I suspect there has to be perhaps a balance between the history that you're describing that fascinates you and others so much, and show business. How do you balance that? Can you give me an example of something that really can't be as accurate as it should be because it's a television show?
Well, loving titles as I do, it's all in the name. I'm the historical advisor. So I advise on what would be right. And I say again, you know, I'm very lucky that they will always try and bring that into effect if I say something should be done. But in the end, we're here to entertain. Downton Abbey is not a documentary. It is an entertainment, a drama. It's all come out of Julian Fellowes's mind. And my role is to try and give as much legitimacy to an imagined story as we possibly can. But I don't get in the way of producing excellent entertainment, I hope.
Before you were in the studio, we were taking some calls on the air from excited fans and people who watch the program, and some people brought up some anachronisms. One of the callers said that she saw or thought she saw in one scene an electric or a Corning-style coffee pot from Corning Glassware, which is here in New York State where we are. Do you have people point out things that they see that may not be quite right? Another caller said that she thought she heard the words learning curve in some of the script. Do you find things like that, or do you have viewers point them out to you?
Well, what's lovely about having the reputation that we do at Downton Abbey is that people are longing to catch us out. And it must be the most glorious sport. I always think, why don't you just get on and enjoy the story? But, you know, we take each of these criticisms with great interest. We ask people, though, not to necessarily assume that any critic is right, because they very often are not. And actually, you know, it's the same thing if you've got a reputation that you do get people saying this. I don't know about this Corning thing. I very much doubt it. I'm sure if there was one, I'd love to have it myself, and I probably wouldn't have allowed it to appear on screen. And, you know, we've had things about two yellow lines down the side of the road in the first series, and that turned out to be sunlight. You know, there are things that we have deliberately not done correctly. For instance, we don't force the actors to speak exactly as aristocrats would have done in the 1920s, because none of you would watch it. They used to speak with the most extraordinarily dislocated jaw, and they spoke something like this. It's almost impossible to get into it at all. And so we try and make it worthwhile for now. And those are the things that I don't think get in the way, but it's just making sure that this is an entertainment and it's accessible. But I don't think you should listen too closely to the naysayers, because actually, on the whole, most of the things that are batted to me are criticisms that are not founded.
Alistair Bruce is the historical advisor to Downton Abbey. He's on the line with us today from London. He'll be visiting Rochester on November 26th, part of a luncheon here that WXXI is hosting at the Hyatt. We'll have details about that coming up in a few minutes. Our telephone number, though, is 263-9994. 263-WXXI, if you'd like to talk directly to Alistair Bruce and ask him questions or make comments on the program. Alistair, we had a few calls before you came onto the program where people were asking us to ask you to describe the accuracy of Thomas's situation. He's a gay man in this time period, and the viewers that called us had a real understanding of what his behavior was like, what he may have been going through. The question that they asked was, what is the accuracy of his situation, how he was being treated? In some cases, some people like Lord Grantham coming to his defense. How would that have played out for someone in that particular era?
Well, I think that a large number of people who were footmen in households of that size were often inclined in that direction. After all, you imagine that you are looking for a job where attention to detail, gentleness, being able to make a better world around you for the person you serve is a skill. And not all men have that, but very often people who are gay have a tremendous ability to create that kind of perfection and have an attention to detail. And so perhaps it was inevitable that a large number of people in these households were indeed gay. Now, of course, in Britain in those days, and indeed right up until 1959, it was illegal to be gay. And therefore, what we've tried to do is to show that there really was this inevitably, because human nature is what it is. But the British have always been disinclined to accept human nature. And perhaps that's true of a number of people in the United States too. But what we've done is we've hit it head on, because it is important to point out that it was terrifying for some of these people living with this desire to be themselves and the restriction upon that by the nature of society. And I hope that what we deliver to people who watch Downton Abbey is a sense of how constrained life was, how everything was regulated by, be it religion, be it correct form in society, be it your position in the house, and all of that constrained natural behaviour. People who are madly in love, be they straight or gay, found it terribly difficult to admit it publicly to each other, because you weren't allowed to get married if you worked below stairs. Generally, it's quite rare that we've got Bates marrying Mrs. Bates. You know, that sort of thing is rare, because this was a very constrained and different time from the one in which we live now.
Do you think that in that case, some of the other situations that we see Sybil, for example, as a character kind of breaking away from what we think of maybe as the family tradition in her relationship with Branson. We see Lady Edith moving more toward feminism. So these things actually did happen for families in pretty much this way, would you say? Or was it even more constrained, or did not happen? Maybe all this wouldn't have happened in one family in those days.
Well, we do pick up an enormous collection of different things that happened in different places and put them into the one family, because we're trying to entertain people. I mean, frankly, it would have been exhausting to live at Downton Abbey with all the things that go on. But you've got to remember that the First World War, the Great War as it was known, was a catalyst for the most enormous social change in Europe. And the effects of that are being played out. And the fact that those constraints I've already referred to were present, and yet the people who'd survived the war, particularly the women, were determined to live life tenfold more than they might have been without the First World War, because they'd seen boyfriends dying on the Western Front. There'd been endless gloom and sadness because people had been killed. And there was this mood to pick up and move forward. And in Britain, socialism was moving into the political structure, and while our first Labour government was only a short distance away, and at the beginning of the next series, which you're about to see, you'll get a sense of the fact that there's great social change. The trade union movement in Great Britain is building up. And so all this change is challenging the way in which Downton Abbey portrays this wonderful big house, the aristocracy, the agrarian economy of the countryside. All that they think is going to last forever. We know it won't.
So your work as historical advisor is ever more into working with things like social issues as they come to the fore in the plot. I know that there's been a lot made in America about Paul Giamatti joining the cast for some episodes. By the way, we should tell our listeners that the people in the UK are watching the series now. It's already been on. So how do you prepare to advise the cast and the producers as we move through time in terms of the historical issues? How do you prepare for your role on the show?
With every new season, I take the actors to one side and I give them a presentation on the history of the time. I try not to be didactic. I seek to absolutely mesmerise them with the period as it was. I say to them, because, you know, people have pretty strong political views today about whether it was right or wrong for an aristocrat to live in the way that they did or for people to serve them in the way that they did. And I ask the actors and actresses, please leave all that personal view and politics outside and transport yourself back in time and accept the status quo as it was and portray it so that the viewer can decide in their own mind whether it was right or wrong. And I think that that works very effectively. And I take each of them aside, as and when they need it, to talk about elements of their storyline in relation to the history that was going on at the time. And you asked before, how do they make something of that knowledge? And that's where you see it. You tell Mrs. Patmore something about the background of her relation who was shot for cowardice in the First World War. Mm-hmm. And I told her all about what used to go on, how soldiers were treated. I used to be a soldier, and I am a soldier. You know, and I've been to war, and I know that the concept of cowardice is a very difficult thing to explain nowadays. So you tell her all that, and then she makes of that the performance that we witnessed.
How do you do your own preparation? You are a historian, obviously. You have a long background in history. Do you have to do any studying?
Oh, all the time. I love reading. I love primary source of that period. Reading diaries, reading letters. You know, a letter from that's the great thing about that period. They all wrote letters because, of course, there were no telephones, or there were, but you didn't get access to it unless you were a butler. And anyway, your family probably didn't have a telephone at the other end, so they all wrote these wonderful letters. And I'm so grateful that an enormous number of families have not thrown all these letters out. And you can read them, and you know how you say about your day in an email to a friend of yours? Well, they did the same thing. They talked about what they'd been doing, you know, just been darning some socks or something. And they describe exactly what then acts as the catalyst for things that I get people to do in the servants' hall in the background. So everything that's being done in the servants' hall stems from a letter of the period written by somebody who worked in service in one of these great houses, and we try and bring that to life in the background.
Alistair Bruce is our guest today on 1370 Connection. He is the historical advisor to Downton Abbey, and of course he is one of the Queen's heralds. He's appointed to advise on state pomp and ceremony and has a long history and background working with in the entertainment field as well, advising on such movies as The King's Speech and Young Victoria. Alistair, you and I have met before. WXXI's Travel Club traveled to England and to Highclere Castle, where Downton Abbey is filmed. You hosted our group also at Highfleet Manor, which is where the scenes of Maggie Smith, the Dowager Countess's home, are filmed. What's it like being on these locations? People are living at Byfleet. They're living at Highclere Castle. So you can't do everything you want to do, or you might slow down the story somewhat. Is that so? What's it like being in a place where people are living?
It's a very symbiotic relationship because, of course, here we arrive with... There are about 100 people in the crew, and then there are about... Well, we have an enormous cast, and we all turn up at these houses. And it must be a tremendous invasion for the people who live there. But at the same time, we're paying to be there. We're also raising the profile of a house like Highclere Castle. And they have been inundated with an enormous number of visitors, not least from the United States, people who want to come and find Downton Abbey, the real Downton Abbey. And so I think Lady Carnarvon has benefited greatly from us being there, although it is probably quite aggravating with the doors open all through a very cold day and endless amounts of television equipment, cameras, makeup trolleys, you know, all the stuff going in and out. And we lay down stuff on the carpet. We protect the walls. There are incredible paintings on some of these gorgeous buildings that we film in that we look after. We're responsible for it. But it is fun. You know, I used to work for Merrill Lynch. You know, I used to sit in front of a massive, great Fisher-Price toy, and the lights used to flash, and I used to get excited when Coca-Cola went up or down a dollar. Do you know, I wasn't interested. What I love is working on a film set and creating wonderful bits of drama. It just does it for me, you know. It doesn't do it for everybody, but I absolutely love it.
Well, there are, as you said, hundreds of millions of people who also absolutely love it. Our guest today, Alistair Bruce, the historical advisor to Downton Abbey. Our phone number is 263-9994, 263-WXXI. If you have a question for Alistair Bruce, let's go to the telephones now. Hi, Debbie. Thanks for calling 1370 Connection.
Hello. I really love the show, and I actually have two questions about historical background of character plot. One is why we don't hear more about Lord Grantham participating in the House of Lords. And the second is, if you can, I don't know if you can, but if you can talk at all about the character that Shirley MacLaine plays. I found her to be over the top for where I think a woman of her age and generation would have been in the U.S. At that time, as I thought about when she would have come of age and how she would have been trained, I wasn't sure that she completely fit. And I'm curious about conversations, if there were any, about that.
Well, looking at your two questions, first of all, let's look at the wonderful Mrs. Levinson. She is a remarkable character. It's a character that Shirley really created herself. In a sense, arriving as she did from the United States to play her part, we had her for such a short time, and it was quite difficult necessarily for me to shape entirely how she wanted to deliver that. I did talk to her to a certain amount about what it was like, as it was for the aristocracy who had no money, and the robber baron families or whatever in the United States had made squillions of dollars, but didn't necessarily have wonderful titles to bandy about. And there was this great sort of arrangement at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century where marriages were very natural between very wealthy American families and, you know, rather run down but grand British families. You know, you only have to go to Blenheim Palace, the home of the Dukes of Marlborough in Britain, this massive, great, big palace that was given to a general in the 1700s for defeating France. We used to always congratulate people for defeating France. But trying to maintain that house was very difficult. And so this marriage with the Vanderbilt, Consuelo Vanderbilt, saved that house, and people still enjoy it today. So we were echoing that. Now, as for the House of Lords, Lord Grantham, we assume, does go to the House of Lords, but actually an enormous number of the peerage, that is, the people who were entitled to sit in the House of Lords, didn't really bother to go, and that was both its strength and its weakness. Only in the last 20 years we've stopped hereditary peers, those are people who've inherited their titles, from having the right to sit in the nation's legislature, which some might think is rather slow to catch up with modern democracy. But we know that Lord Grantham can go there. One of our difficulties is that if you're going to send Lord Grantham to the House of Lords, What's he going to do there in story terms? And what is the cost going to be to us of taking over the House of Lords for the weekend in order to take the plot further forward? And the answer is, we haven't yet had the plot point that we need to take us there. When we do, I'm sure we'll go.
Our telephone number is 263-9994, 263-WXXI. Since we're talking about plot points with Alistair Bruce, the historical advisor to Downton Abbey, let me ask you about one of the big plot points at the end of Series 3, Season 3, and that, of course, is the birth of baby George, Mary and Matthew's young son. Now, where would he sit in the lineage at this point? Could his birthright be threatened if, for example, Patrick were to come back? We know we've had questions about that from many viewers about whether Patrick will come back. Where does baby George sit in the lineage?
It's often very muddling to work out how the lineage of a British lord works out. But basically, and to keep it as simple as I can, a British peerage, which we regard the Grantham one to be, only goes through the male line, and therefore, as we know, Robert Grantham, Lord Grantham, has three daughters, one of whom is no more, and they cannot inherit. So we look to the next male heir in line of birth, but all of them have to be descended from the first Lord Grantham. So they are the only ones who qualify. So they all have to descend from the first Lord Grantham. And you keep looking sideways until you find a man. Now, Patrick, you're right, was claiming to be the man who would have been the next Lord Grantham after the one that we know, Hugh Bonneville, dies. But the truth is, it would appear he has not made the grade in terms of proving to be that person. You know, that's what we think at the moment. So young George is the heir. And it's nothing to do with his mother. It all comes through Matthew, because Matthew was the male through which the right came. And that's what's so unfair about the British system. And we are, as I say, disinclined to accept human nature over here. But peerage law is very clear. Peerages of the United Kingdom of Great Britain pass through the male line absolute and never go through the female line. Scottish peerages are different. Prior to 1603, they go through the female line.
We are getting a great lesson in history today, world history, from Alistair Bruce, the historical advisor to Downton Abbey, and we're also learning a lot of great information about the program. Downton Abbey Season 4 premieres on WXXI television on Sunday, January 5th at 9 p.m., part of Masterpiece Theatre. Also, as we've been saying, Alistair Bruce will be visiting Rochester. We will bring him here. WXXI is bringing him here to celebrate the next season of Downton Abbey. He'll be at a luncheon, our guest at a luncheon at the Hyatt. And if you are interested in tickets for that luncheon, you can go to our website at WXXI.org, and I'll give the telephone number that you can call at the end of this program. If you'd like to speak to Alistair Bruce or ask a question, make a comment about Downton Abbey, please call us at 263-9994, 263-WXXI. Let's go to the telephone now. Keith has been waiting. Thanks so much for your patience, Keith.
Hello. Alistair, got a couple quick questions. I'd like to test your knowledge on your biography. Mentioned that you do some consulting with movies. Did you ever see the movie The Others? It was with Nicole Kidman. It was depicted to be happening sort of like an English manor house during World War II, or possibly on an island or something. The movie was really good, but the house that it was in and all the, which was part of the movie, I thought was very good, but I didn't know if it was really accurately depicted.
Keith, do you know, I haven't seen it, and I'm going to rush out to get it and watch it. And if I can possibly get the message back to you, what I think, in due course I will. But I must say, you know, there are an enormous number of movies. Some of them worry about history and some don't. There was one called Braveheart,
yes,
which was done by Mel Gibson, and it purported to tell the story of Scotland and the history of the beginning of the Wars of Independence with England. Now, as I've explained to listeners before, I am a descendant from Robert the Bruce. And in it, we see William Wallace, this great hero of Scottish national life. And he's depicted as a sort of working class hero. He was nothing of the sort. And then my ancestor, Robert the Bruce, was portrayed as some pusillanimous idiot. And so, you know, stories do get in the way of history a lot. But in the end, when you work in the kind of business that I do, you have to accept that it's entertainment first, and you try and make sure that history lives too. And I'm just really grateful to Julian Fellowes and the producers of this show that they really care. I mean, they put an enormous amount of emphasis in supporting me in delivering the historical accuracy, and that makes it more fun for me.
We've been talking today about Downton Abbey, and of course Downton Abbey is filmed at Highclere Castle, and parts of it are filmed, we talked a little bit about filming unseen in houses where people are living at Byfleet Manor, for example, but the downstairs scenes are not shot, first of all, anywhere near the upstairs set, and they are actually on a set. Will you describe for us, Alistair Bruce, your work on that part of the program? That has to be quite a bit different, and I don't think that we realize as viewers maybe that the two sets of cast members almost never see each other.
There is a sort of division between those who live above stairs and those who work below stairs because of the fact that we do film their scenes in a very different place. I mean, it's about an hour and a half by car apart. But Ealing Studios, where all those wonderful Ealing comedies, if you like old English movies, were shot during the sort of the 30s and 40s and 50s, that this wonderful building, still the very same sets, are our home. And inside is all the below stairs world, and also there's many of the bedrooms as we can put in there from Highclere, because actually it's impossible to film in the bedrooms at the castle because they're too constrained, we get too hot, it's generally in the summer and everyone loses their tempers. But if you've got this wonderful set, you can do whatever you like with it. My role is to work with the props department in actually decorating it, putting it together, making sure that every detail within it is correct, then working with the staff actors, the actors who are playing the staff, to teach them how to use the different things. For instance, you will see that whenever it's evening time, the valets will lay out the clothes in front of the fire just to warm it. You know, those tiny details, and they bring that into their acting. Then I suppose my worst business is working in the kitchens when we've got fish on the menu, because you start at 8 o'clock in the morning doing the first takes for the fish course. And if you're still at it at lunchtime, under the lights, I can tell you the fish ceases to be a pleasure to work with.
I can imagine. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the plots and characters. We had some calls earlier with questions about characters. Someone writes in to say, will O'Brien ever be back? And another question related to that, why is it that O'Brien, in the plot anyway, can go off and go somewhere else and live, but Matthew must be killed off? Is there a reason for that?
Well, I think it's really practical, because we believe, or at least Julian Fellowes directs as the writer, that if you're telling the story of a house which is owned by a particular family, and one of those cast members decides they want to go off, I don't know, they get wonderful film opportunities, and you know that's life and you expect it, then they can't really just disappear for a time and come back. Can you imagine Matthew as the father of this new child if he cleared off for a whole period of time with no real reason? I mean, it just, A, would simply not sit with the period, and B, I don't think anyone would feel very warmly to him when he came back, least of all his wife. So we have taken the view that if you are in the family and you wish to leave Downton Abbey for whatever reason, then you probably have to die. And if you are below stairs, then you can go off and get another job, and that's simply the reason why.
Alistair Bruce is the historical advisor to Downton Abbey. He's with us on 1370 Connection today. And if you're enjoying the conversation, there's more to come. WXXI is bringing Alistair Bruce to Rochester on November 26th. Alistair will be our guest and the speaker at a luncheon at the Hyatt. There's information on tickets and a VIP reception on our website at WXXI.org. And, of course, Season 4, Series 4 of Downton Abbey begins on January 5th at 9 p.m., part of Masterpiece Theater on WXXI Television. We have a little fewer than 20 minutes left with Alistair Bruce in our program. We're going to take a short break. You can call 263-9994 with your question. We'll take a short break and be back in 30 seconds right after this.
This is WXXI AM Rochester and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
We're back on 1370 Connection with Alistair Bruce, the historical advisor to Downton Abbey, who's joining us from a studio in London today on the live line with us. And certainly we appreciate your time, Alistair. Thanks for being here. In addition to all of the things that we've talked about and your positions and your expertise on history, you're also a commentator. And American TV audiences have seen you on Good Morning America. You've commented on most of the major national events in the United Kingdom, including the royal wedding in 2011, the Queen's Diamond Jubilee last year, the papal visit, the funeral of the Queen Mother. Tell me a little bit about your work in media. You also teach media as well. So what is that like for you, working in the media and talking to and dealing with American audiences as well?
Well, I love telling stories, and as a commentator of a big national event, it's rather like a sports commentator. You know, there is the game being played by all those taking part, and your role is to try and just help the viewer, who probably knows everything they need to know about the sport, to just better appreciate the event that they're watching. And with a great national occasion, when Great Britain or the United States chooses to do some set piece, like the royal wedding of Prince William to Catherine Middleton. That is an event when you can help the viewer just get into the extraordinary story. And I love detail. And I don't accept that anything is done by accident. And I believe that when you're watching traditions unroll before you, it's great to find out the reasons behind each one. And I suppose as a broadcaster, I've learnt how to do that. And I was out in Rome. In fact, I had to leave Downton Abbey filming, rushed out to Rome when Benedict XVI, the Pope, left office. And I went to watch the whole process in St. Peter's Square while they selected Pope Francis. I am madly interested in the doctrine, structure and way in which the Vatican operates. And so I can probably bring that to life for our audience as well. And talking to American audiences, I know that there's a great deal of interest in our monarchy, the stories of Britain, why we do things. And I think that, you know, I always think there's a pub story. I know you don't have pubs in the same way as we do, but in Britain, at the end of a hard day, people go to the pub and they get a drink and they sit together and they talk about things. And what I'm trying to tell people as a commentator is a story that they'll take to the pub in the evening and say, "God, did you know?" And then they tell this story that I hope I passed on. And thereby, you make the event, the story that has taken place that I have commentated, more the possession of the viewer.
All right, let's take a telephone call now. Our phone number is 263-9994. Thanks for calling, Samantha. Did you have a question?
Oh, yes, I do. It's wonderful to hear Mr. Bruce speaking, and I just love the show, and I loved the King's Speech. My question to him is, how did he acquire his knowledge? Did he go to university, or did you just find a passion for it and just studied up, or it's just ingrained in your British self, or what?
Samantha, like so many children, I was a great worry to my parents. I completely failed at school because I was dyslexic and everyone just thought I was thick. But actually, the truth is, I had quite a good brain and I was really interested in things, although I could never really write in the coherent manner that was equal to the way I could speak. So I suppose I had difficulties from that school, but I just was fascinated in things, Samantha. I don't know what really fascinates you, but you'll find when you're really interested in something, when a young person is fascinated, they'll pick up the tiniest details and they'll never forget. I mean, I forget to ring up my mother on her birthday, but I remember how many buttons the Scots Guards pipers wear down the side of their spats. You know, this is the extraordinary nature of being fascinated about a particular subject, and I am, and it's been great to bring that into the business of making film.
Thanks for the call, Samantha. We appreciate it. Let's go to line two now. Our telephone lines are lighted up, so if you don't get an answer right away, please be patient. Line two now. David is on the line. Thanks for waiting, David.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. Alistair, wonderful work. It's an amazing series. This year, my lady and I went up to Niagara-on-the-Lake for a couple of visits, and we saw a play up there called Our Betters. And it's a play about the rich American women that went seeking title over to England. They may have been widowers or divorcees or perhaps inherited their fortunes. I didn't quite get at the beginning of the series, is Cora one of those women that went over to find a link to title and marry into it, or did the Lord go seeking this, you know, seeking the funds to, you know, to keep Downton Abbey going?
Well, to be honest, David, you're right in almost all of that, because what Cora represents, who's Our Lady Grantham, is that she is from a very wealthy family. They've done extremely well, and they have found the opportunity to place their daughter in a socially advantageous place because she's married into the British aristocracy. She's now the Countess of Grantham, Lady Grantham, and treated with all honour. Whereas perhaps her family background, she may not have been one of the Pilgrim Fathers' descendants. She may have come across, as many families did, as a result of the rather dismal Irish potato famine. But whatever it was, she has now, through the incredible wealth of her family, married into rather a grand house, which has been saved by that money, and she can enjoy lording it around in the world of British aristocratic life. But, you know, one of the reasons we find her rather an interesting character is, can you imagine being brought up in America and then finding yourself in a drafty old castle in the middle of Yorkshire? And we're rather interested to watch how Cora deals with that, because I expect she would love to be back in America sometimes.
Interesting. But so she didn't seek it, or did her mother prepare her for this and then make the connection? How was the connection made? Or you're just leaving that to the viewer to sort of wonder about?
I think in all marriages there is a sort of mutual seeking, isn't there? Even if it's just between two people. And I think here what we've got is that she desperately, or at least her family, I think, took the view that what mattered in a world where they had everything was that they didn't have this sort of, if it's important, but perhaps it was then, this cachet of class and European standing. Whereas, on the other side of the pond, over in Britain, there's all this class and cachet, if that's what you call it, but no money. And you've got to keep these places going. And the decision was to make these marriages work. Some of them were very happy, and some of them most definitely were not. Some people were miserable. And I say again, I mean, as you look into some of these amazing American brides, they had a terrible time. And it's well worth reading into it because, you know, there are plenty of families like mine. I come from a pretty old-fashioned British family, and I've got lots of American cousins purely as a result of these kinds of marriages. And it's always so nice to go and see them. They live in such grandeur and style, and then they come over and see us in sort of hopeless, worn-out carpets and rather enjoying a cold day and saying, isn't this lovely?
Thank you very much for the call. Let's go now to line four. Tom's been waiting in Greece. Tom, you had a question for Alistair Bruce?
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Oh, okay. This is briefly to your to Mr. Bruce about young Victoria. At the emotional, one of the emotional climaxes of the scenes is of the movie is where Prince Albert is carried into the palace and he's bloodstained because he's been wounded by a would-be assassin. But I mean, that never happened. There were attempts to kill Victoria and Albert, but they were never harmed by any of them. And I was wondering how, as the historical advisor, you allowed that to happen.
Well, it's a good question. Why did I allow that to happen? Well, I wanted to get my check at the end of the week. And basically, what was decided, there were 9 separate attempts on Queen Victoria's life, rather amazingly. Very few people realise that. But what did happen is that there were these consecutive attempts on her life on Constitution Hill, which was just outside Buckingham Palace. And Prince Albert had come up with the idea of taking her out on this journey for a second time just to see if they could track down the man who was putting her in danger, which I think shows immense bravery or stupidity on both their parts. But look, the decision was taken that in order to create a moment where Victoria realizes the value of her husband in absolute clarity, this was the decision that was taken. And I think that the difficulty when you're trying to tell a whole story in what is ostensibly entertainment. You cannot sit around for weeks and weeks and weeks looking at what really did make Queen Victoria finally fall in love with her husband, and it was generally tiny details of adjustment he made to the letters she wrote, ways in which he helped her sort out her life and gave her confidence as a woman in a pretty tough world. Now, that doesn't read well if you've gone to the movies with a box of popcorn. So the answer is, I sat there with some alarm and watched Albert's dripping blood and knew, just as indeed your caller did, that this never happened. But I don't think it stopped a good story.
Alistair Bruce, historical advisor to Downton Abbey, an expert on state ritual and social manners and behavior of the aristocracy throughout history. Thank you so much for your time today on 1370 Connection. We will see you in about a month from now here in Rochester.
I can't wait.
Looking forward to it. Alistair Bruce is going to be coming to Rochester. WXXI will bring Alistair Bruce to Rochester on November 26th. He will be our guest and speaker at luncheon at the Hyatt. There's information on tickets and on a VIP reception with Alistair Bruce on our website, WXXI.org. Or for information about tickets to the luncheon, you can call us at 258-0200, 258-0200. And of course, season 4 of Downton Abbey begins on January 5th at 9 p.m. on WXXI Television, part of Masterpiece Theater. Thank you for listening today. The news is coming up next, and then after that, we'll have Here and Now. You'll hear a candidate free airtime on the air this afternoon. And if you missed any part of this program, you can hear a repeat of the program at 10 p.m. tonight on WXXI Radio. You're listening to member-supported WXXI Public Radio. For our technical director, John Andrus, I'm Elisa Orlando. Thanks for listening.